glad you're here. Fellowship's sweeter, knowing you're near. It's so good to see you. I hope that it's fair. Everyone loves you. We're glad you're here.
Welcome to Mark and Friends for Thursday, October 26th, 2023. I'm your host, Donna Leland. Today, Kim Witsack will share her story of how God showed himself strong in a time of incredible heartache and need. We hope her story will encourage you to know that we have a God who cares about the little details of our lives and how God can use what man means for evil, but for the good to save many lives. Welcome, Kim, to Mark and Friends.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Your story today involves your husband, Woody. So how did you and Woody meet?
Well, I met my husband, Woody, on my birthday, June 1st, and it was at one of the local bars where he hung out. He went to DePaul University, and it just randomly, or not randomly, you know, I think it was kind of a God-ordained meeting. I was waiting to go to the bathroom in this crowded space, and I just started talking to this guy who overheard me say something about Minnesota. And so he was pretending he was from Minnesota, and we ended up going on a date like 3 days later, and we're together the rest of the lives together that we had.
Sounds like you got your dream husband, he got his dream wife, and then he got his dream job. Tell us about it.
He had just started his dream job with a startup company and was having trouble sleeping, and Woody was a guy that always needed 8 hours of sleep, no matter. And that's really what started the whole, what eventually became the end, you know, the demise of him, but also the start of, you know, my new life as I have today.
Walk us through Woody's final days.
Sure. Woody went to his doctor when he wasn't able to sleep, you know, was asking just for some help. And he went to the doctor and left with a 3-week sample pack of an antidepressant Zoloft and was said it would help take the edge off and help him sleep. Woody, you know, was a good patient, you know, followed doctor's orders, etc. So he started in on the medication that he was received. And I happened to be out of the country the first 3 weeks he was put on this drug. It was my busy time of year. I'm an advertising producer. So I was actually in New Zealand. And so I wasn't there when Woody first got put on these medications, but I was during this time still speaking with him, you know, as much as I can with the time difference, as well as, you know, my parents were, you know, having him over for dinner because they knew that he was going to be home alone for 3 weeks. There was, you know, nothing at that point that was giving me any alarm with Woody taking this medication. And quite honestly, I didn't even know what the medication was. You know, I knew it was a drug that the doctor gave it to him, and Woody did what most people do, which was follow the doctor's orders. I eventually came home after 3 weeks, and I'll never forget something that will haunt me probably the rest of my life just because it was so horrible watching. Woody had walked in the back door. I was excited. I was finally home from, you know, work, and was going to spend the evening with him, made dinner, and Woody came through our back door. He was completely drenched in his dress shirt with a white t-shirt underneath, and he was crying, and he dropped his bag on the floor and fell into a fetal position in front of our dishwasher, and he held his head like around his hands around his head like a vice, and he kept pulling his hand away and kept going, "Kim, help me, I don't know what's happened to me, I'm losing my mind, you gotta help me," and he's bawling, and he goes, "I don't think I can handle one of this, you gotta help me," and I was like, "What?" And I remember just looking at it going, "I've never seen this before." So eventually we calmed him down, you know, we prayed, eventually he called his doctor and was telling his doctor about this head outside the feeling, you know, his head. And the doctor said, "You got to give the drug 4 to 6 weeks to kick in." That was week four. So again, as I mentioned, it was my busy time of my year, and I had to go out of town again for another advertising shoot. And the couple days the weekend before, we hosted a big engagement party at our house, and Woody was totally Woody. Like, he was on, he was full of, you know, his funny, outgoing, huge personality, you know, classic entertainer. And there was nothing that, you know, seemed out of the ordinary for me. So on Monday morning, I left to go out of town, and because we both traveled a lot for work, and so we always had our routine of checking in the morning and then calling multiple times during the day. So again, nothing seemed out of the ordinary. And then on August 6th, I remember it was actually the night before, I had talked to Woody, and he seemed really distracted, and there was something going on. I don't know if it was that same head outside the body feeling again that he was having. I remember, you know, saying goodbye to him, I love you. And then the next morning, I had a really funny dream to tell him on August 6th. So I called Woody, and it, you know, multiple times during the day, and it went to voicemail, and I was like, that's so bizarre. And so finally, I called my dad, and I said, hey, Dad, do me a favor. Will you go over to my house? I'm afraid Woody maybe hit his head. He's been having trouble sleeping, so I haven't heard from him, so I just don't know. Maybe something happened. And so my dad, you know, they live maybe 4 or 5 miles away from my house. So my dad went over and you know, looked, and eventually, you know, his car was there. He wasn't in the house. And then he opens the garage, and there was Woody hanging from the rafters of our garage. Little did I know my dad had to make that call, and I will never forget it. My dad called, and he's like, it's bad, it's bad. He's like screaming. I'm like, what do you mean it's bad? And he's like, Woody's dead. And I'm like, what? Like, what do you mean Woody's dead? What do you mean Woody's dead? Like, I'm still on, you know, in the middle of my production. It's 9 o'clock at night. I'm out in the studio in Detroit, and he's telling me my husband's dead. And I was like, I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean he's dead? I literally couldn't even get my head around that. And my dad's like, he's hanging. I'm like, what? They're like, he's hanging. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you know, just that idea. And I was like, hanging, literally to this day, still makes no sense. But I have, obviously, it's been 20 years, and, you know, it's become what I do for advocacy. But that phone call in that moment, my life, everything that I knew, everything that I had planned, you know, my life was going exactly the way we were, you know, assuming it was going to go, or I was assuming it was going to go. We were just starting to talk about having kids. We had just booked our 10-year anniversary trip. And in that one phone call, my life changed forever.
Like you said, even after 20 years, just the depth of the pain is still so very evident in your voice.
Yeah, it was a horrific, horrific call. And I can't even imagine what it must have been like for my dad to make that phone call and discovery, because he's profoundly changed from it. It still, that one still gets me choked up thinking about my dad having to discover it. But then I know I always hear my dad say, well, thank God it was me that discovered it and not Kim. You know, regardless, it was horrible. And, you know, it really, at that point, trying to make sense of what happened, I'm like, how did this guy who loved life take his own life? He didn't have, you know, he wasn't depressed. He wasn't suffering depression. Like, the night that he was found, obviously, you know, they had to call the cops and the coroner, and everybody came over. The coroner asked me a question. She said, was Woody taking any medication? The only medication he was taking was Zoloft, which is the antidepressant. And she proceeded to tell us that it might have something to do with his death, and she was going to take the bottle with her. Ironically, the same night that Woody was found, the front page of our local newspaper had an article that said the UK finds link between antidepressants and suicide in teens. And really, those two pieces of information became kind of the, you know, the note that I never got from Woody. And it became kind of the impetus for what became the journey, as I call it, the accidental advocate journey of discovery of being the drug safety advocacy work that I do today.
It does seem only natural to want to have a note to find out why he made that choice. But in this case, there was no note.
Yes, I was looking for a note. Woody always left notes. Like, he left notes in my car. He left notes in my suitcase because, you know, like I said, we both traveled. And here was Woody's biggest trip of his life, and there was no note. And, you know, I look back at the two signs that became, you know, really what started me on this journey. But, you know, that bottle of, when the coroner asked if he was on any medication, you know, I originally said the bottle of medication was upstairs in the medicine cabinet, but she said, no, it's sitting under a light on the kitchen counter. And, you know, I often look back and go, wow, was that like kind of a God thing? Like, how did that bottle get down on that kitchen counter? Even in those horrific, horrific, horrific moments, there were like little glimpses where God was present in there that I didn't see at that moment. And, you know, my brother-in-law, who's married to my sister, came over eventually with, you know, my sister and my mom. And he was just, it made no sense to him either, because Woody was, again, this guy who loved life, full of life, was always forward-thinking, positive. It literally made no sense, like, why a guy would take his own life. And so, really, I thank God for Eric, my brother-in-law, as well, because that night, when I'm sitting in Detroit trying to figure out how am I going to get home and to have to come home to this life that I don't even know what it is anymore. But Eric, my brother-in-law, something didn't make sense to him while this was all happening. And he went home that night and Googled Zoloft and suicide and found that the FDA had hearings on antidepressant when it was just Prozac in the market and the emergence of violence and suicide in 1991. I mean, I was just, you know, I think back to 1991, where was I? I was just starting out my new job in Chicago and I had just met Woody. This would have been the furthest thing I would have ever even been paying attention to. So, you know, I look back and thank God for my brother-in-law, and who is really, really, really a big piece of this whole puzzle as well. Thinking back to August 6, 2003, the life that I knew and loved came crashing down.
So they had this information about these antidepressants and the connection to suicide in the 90s, and they kept it silent?
Yes, they knew about the information in 1991. There was FDA advisory committees that, and they had a lot of people that were public hearings that eventually I was involved in 2004 and 2006, but that were almost the exact same story that Woody was talking about at when it was just Prozac on the market. And at that time, all of the members on that committee took funding from pharmaceutical companies making antidepressants, and the FDA, so they voted, nope, we don't see any association between the emergence of violence and suicide and the drugs. The FDA told Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, to study suicidality. They never did, and the FDA never followed up with them. And meanwhile, you know, here comes Zoloft, another one of the antidepressants, and Paxil, another one, and approval for children, all during the time before Woody's death in 2003.
You referred to yourself as an accidental advocate. Take us to that next piece of your journey where God begins to use all the information that's being gleaned concerning Woody's death.
In the deepest, deepest, deepest part of me, I knew something didn't make sense with how Woody's life ended. it was counter to everything the way he lived his life. You know, he always said, I'll never judge my life based on my how much money I make. My career will be based on my family and my friends and leaving the world a better place. He was an amazing uncle. He showed up. He was an amazing employee, like, and our, you know, now partner at this new company, his friends, his family. It made no sense that this guy would take his own life, right? But yet everybody around me was telling me he must have been depressed. And I was like, well, I don't think he was depressed because I would have, you know, seen this, especially being as tight as we were and, you know, during this whole time. And, you know, for anybody who's ever had to go through something like this, you know, when somebody dies suddenly, you almost go into this investigative mode to figure out what happened. I didn't know, you know, what Eric, my brother-in-law, was doing while I was just intuitively thinking, like, this doesn't make sense, and trying to figure out, you know, my broken heart that was shattered. And I remember a couple, like, it was a week after the funeral, and I was sitting in my basement, and I remember literally crying and bawling. And so for anybody who's ever had that kind of pain, it's real, and it's like a deep, deep gut-wrenching pain. And I kept praying to God, take my pain and use it. It does me no good. I kept like saying that over and over and over as I was bawling, because I just wanted that pain to go away. And so that's where I was, trying to make sense of just what happened. And little did I know, again, what my brother-in-law was starting to pull together. And so eventually he came to me and he said, I think I figured out what happened to Woody. And so that really became when he started presenting me things. And he literally, I don't think that guy slept for a week straight. And he had two little kids at this point. And my sisters, you know, my sister said he didn't even come to bed at night because he was just poring over books. And God gave him like the right, I mean, he started writing to people who wrote these books. Like there were books called the, you know, Prozac, Talking Back to Prozac, the Antidepressant Fact Book, like all of these things that I had no idea even existed, because I didn't even really know that Woody was taking an antidepressant. Like I knew nothing about these drugs. Eventually, like as I said, Eric came to me and showed me things. I'm like, oh my gosh, this must be what's going on. I'm like, we got to do something. You know, I was like, we got to do something. We got to do something. And I think eventually, you know, that's what we did. We went out to Washington, D.C., and we were going to make sure everybody knew about this, because if it can happen to somebody like Woody and who wasn't depressed, it can happen, you know, to others, and we wanted to do what we could. And during this time, you know, when we started going out to, right before we went out to D.C., Woody always said that he wanted his ashes, you know, thrown out on Lake Michigan, which is where he considered home. He was a military brat, lived all over the world, but his parents and grandparents were born and raised in Chicago, and he went to college in Chicago. So he always called Chicago home. And so he said, when I die, don't put me in the ground. I want my ashes thrown on the middle of Lake Michigan. About maybe a month after Woody died. And meanwhile, Eric, this is all like at the same time that Eric just presented this information to me about what he thinks happened. And I'm like, let's go for it. But everybody around us was telling us, you can't, you know, they were telling Eric, you can't do this to Kim. And they're telling me like, hold on. Like you are hurting. Like you can't go take on a big drug company. You can't take on this issue. Like you don't even know. And I'm like, no, I do know. Like I just knew, like in every part of my body, I knew that this was it. So we had a funeral service at a Catholic church where he grew up in Chicago. And then afterwards, his brother is a Chicago cop, and he arranged to have the Chicago search and rescue boat take us out into the middle of Lake Michigan to disperse Woody's ashes and to, you know, fulfill what his wishes of being thrown in Lake Michigan. A small group of us, obviously his family and my family, as well as some friends, went out into the middle of Lake Michigan. And I remember I'm sitting at the edge of the boat with my brother-in-law, Eric, and I'm holding this box of ashes. And I was like, this doesn't even make sense. Like, I can't believe this is what we are. Like, we are ashes. Like, this doesn't even make sense. Like, this is not Woody. I can't believe, like, it just felt super surreal. At that moment, I looked down, and again, we're in the middle of the lake. You know, he wanted it in front of Oak Street Beach. And I looked down in the middle of the water, maybe not even 2-3 feet out on the side of the boat. And I go, what is that? I go, is that a book floating? And it was this red book, open, like, you know, you almost like Hollywood. And I said, does that say what I think it does, Eric? And he goes, yeah. And it, in gold letters, it said, the Holy Bible. And it floated right by the two of us. And I was like, in that moment, Eric and I looked at each other. And first of all, I'm glad it wasn't just me that saw it, because then it would look like, oh, she's just crazy widow again, you know, seeing things. It was like the two of our eyes saw it. And then other people saw something float by. In that moment, I was like, oh, God is saying, Woody's with me. Trust me. This is so much bigger than you even begin to understand what this is all about. Trust me. Woody's here with me. And that's what it said at that moment for me.
Yeah.
And for Eric, I think it was like, it was the sign of keep going. You are right on this. I need you to keep going and telling Woody's story. That happened, and you know, we threw Woody's ashes out and came back to get off the boat. And I remember asking the crusty old Chicago cop who was sitting there, and I said, can I ask you a question? And he said, what? And I go, have you ever like pulled a Bible out of Lake Michigan? And he goes, ma'am, I've been doing this search and rescue work for 25 years. No, I've never pulled a Bible out because books don't float. And I was like, all right, that's all I needed to know. Because it was such an amazing gift that I was given, but it also doesn't make sense because books don't float, right?
There's so much more to the story of Kim Witsack and her testimony before a Senate subcommittee in Washington, D.C. We'll pick it up next Thursday on Mark and Friends. Mark and Friends is a ministry of Great News Media and the WLUJ family of stations.